Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
We expect to see a boomerang to these years. And our position now on all these issues we've talked about is to define what we want. What do we want from healthcare? What do we want from trade? What do we want from the internet? How do we serve ourselves and the future generations? And I think that all comes down to that fight about public versus corporate, and that's the fight.
That's one of our guests today on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Kevin Zeese, joined by Dr. Margaret Flowers, both of whom have marshaled a compendium of key issues for American citizens onto their newly reworked website, popularresistance.org. Hello, and welcome to our year-end edition of the program. I'm Walt McCree, Chair Emeritus of the Public Banking Institute and Ellen Brown's co-host. Today, we're going to take an overview look at some of the key economic issues facing our nation's future to understand more of what we're up against and how we're going to fix the mess we've inherited from a civic system that's run by corporate interests. The many challenges facing efforts to employ and/or retain democratic control of our assets, institutions, and politics seem to be reaching a crescendo. The failure of our economic system to support over half of our population with sufficient resources, driven by runaway systemic inequality, continues unabated, as recently confirmed in a report by the United Nations, describing the United States as the world champion of extreme inequality, one of the most inequitable economic environments on the planet. This scathing assessment of our situation is witnessed each day in the lives of millions of Americans who are now restless with basic concerns of survival and personal prospect, and who are increasingly making personal commitments to work for serious change to our economic and political systems. We all see captured regulators handing over control of major public institutions and policies that serve profiteers over public interest, from the utility of the internet to the essential worlds of education and healthcare and much more. Ellen and I will talk with Kevin and Margaret about some of these issues and the new empowered movement of public resistance, which they predict will be coming to a head in the not-too-distant future. Many of these segments of civic concern are based on the underlying reality that our monetary system is based on debt. Debt issued by the private issuers of our money and credit, primarily private banks and their cohorts, beginning at the Federal Reserve and executed through the channels of life's needs by the mavens of Wall Street. Ellen has a new article out addressing one of the best-known public issues of our day, the financing of student debt.
Your latest article on student debt is kind of reopening an old wound, isn't it?
Well, the wound's getting worse and worse. Student debt is now up to almost $1.4 trillion, which is the second largest category after home mortgages. So that means there's more student debt out there than there is credit card debt. So credit cards are something that everybody has. Students are a small segment, theoretically, of the population. So that's a huge burden for these young people. At one time, tuition in the U.S. was free. I went to Berkeley for free, and I went to UCLA Law School for very little. You know, it was very cheap in the 70s. Berkeley was free in the 60s. And we had free education going back to the college land grant system of the 1860s, and that was when Lincoln's government doubled the money supply by printing greenbacks or U.S. notes. So they just printed the money, and they did amazing things with it. They basically won the war, or, you know, that was the money that allowed them to win the war. And they built the Transcontinental Railroad, and they set up this college system that was free. Tuition was free.
Was that the land-grant college?
Yeah, well, what they did was they granted land to the various states that was federal lands, and then the states could sell that or use that to set up the universities.
Uh-huh.
So that's why it was called land grant. So we have a long history of tuition being free. It was public education was considered a responsibility of the government, and now it's turned into a way to make big bucks for investors. It's a very safe investment. I mean, that when tuition shot way up was in 1998, Sallie Mae was privatized. That's the student loan was federal, became private, so investors got involved. And in 1998, Congress passed a law that students could not file for bankruptcy. This is for federal loans. And then in 2005, that was extended to private loans. So here are students that are easily sucked into these loans. I mean, they're young. They don't really know what they're getting into. They think that they'll be able to pay them back. I mean, that this is their ticket to getting a good job, is to get a good education, and then they can pay the loans back. They don't understand things like compound interest. And so some people wind up paying on these loans for a lifetime, for an entire lifetime, and they can't file for bankruptcy. And so that has actually encouraged the private lenders, and the universities could raise their tuitions, whatever the market would bear. And here you had a market that would bear a lot, because lenders were quite willing to lend to these young people, even though they had no credit history and no visible means of paying it back, because they knew that these kids couldn't get out of it. They were stuck with it, with the private loans as well. As I guess the reason they did it, it was kind of vague why they did it for the federal loans, but evidently the argument was that, well, the taxpayers are paying and they're going to be on the hook if these taxpayers default. But, of course, you can't stop them from defaulting. If they can't pay, they can't pay. They're still in default. And there are plenty of other types of loans that the government makes where you can file for bankruptcy. So this is 1998, you know, when the private investors were getting into all sorts of things. The Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005 is when derivatives and repo were made allowed to go first in a bankruptcy. So there are all kinds of rights that were just kind of slipped in there without a lot of congressional debate that favored the banks. So how do we get out of it? That's the question. I mean, what we should do is do like Lincoln did, do some quantitative easing and just print the money and make tuition free. There are a number of European countries that have free tuition for their universities, and they're getting along fine. Germany's one of them. It's just gone back to free tuition. And, of course, they have a very strong public banking sector. But the other option, if we can't get the federal government to do it, which isn't looking likely at the moment, is to look to our state-owned banks, of which we currently have one, but we have hopes for more. Now, I know in New Jersey, where you are from, where Phil Murphy just got elected governor, he's talking about student loans being one of his major loan categories. And in North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota, it's their second largest loan category after after business loans, and it's pretty close to a third of their loan portfolio. So they make a lot of student loans.
Mm-hmm.
And people think, well, that's not safe, but it's very safe. They turn a very nice profit, and a third of their loans are for students. So how do they do that? Well, they cut out the middlemen, which allows them to make lower interest loans and still make a profit, because they've taken all that extra that everyone else is paying by going through Wall Street.
Are you saying that the student loans in North Dakota are delivered directly from Bank of North Dakota, or do they work with community banks?
They work with the community. Community banks do the loan first, and then they go to the Bank of North Dakota for funding. They have this thing called Deal One, where you can consolidate your loans. So if you've got federal and private loans, a number of loans, you can put them all together in one package, and the interest rate is substantially lower through the Bank of North Dakota, and there are no fees. It makes it very convenient for the students.
And do you have to live in North Dakota?
Well, you do, but it is a recruiting tool, so that if you live there for 6 months, you can do it. So it's a way to bring young people in to say you can get this benefit after 6 months.
And their interest rates compare?
Yeah, right? Their interest rates are, I think it's between 2 and 5% lower than the, well, it's 5% lower than the private fixed
5%.
Rate. 5%. Private fixed rate is close to 8% for variable and close to 10% for fixed.
Wow.
And Bank of North Dakota, I think, is close to 3 for variable and 5 for fixed. But anyway, it's around there.
Yeah.
And the federal loans vary from about 4% to 7%, depending on the graduate students are much more expensive. I'm not sure why that is. I guess they figure if you made it that far, you're going to get a nice job, and so you can afford this stuff. But they're just being exploited horribly. I started this article out with that quote, the Hazard Circular of the 1860s.
Yeah.
I'll just read it if you want to hear. Slavery is likely to be abolished by the war power and chattel slavery destroyed. That's, you know, slavery where you possess the people. This I and my European friends are glad of, for slavery is but the owning of labor and carries with it the care of the laborers. While the European plan, led by England, is that capital shall control labor by controlling wages. In other words, if you have slaves, you have to feed them, you have to house them, their property, so you don't want them to do dangerous things like go down in the mines. So they used to send the Irish down in the mines because they were expendable. So
wow.
If you just don't pay them enough, and you can always keep them in debt, then you can keep them working long and outrageous hours at jobs they don't really like. And you can do that, as the Hazard Circular went on, by basically keeping money tight. And so they said, we can't have those greenbacks out there because we can't control the greenbacks. So that's the whole, they've been doing that for 200 years, is keeping money tight. In other words, there's not enough money out there. And so people have to borrow to meet their basic living expenses.
Right.
Or businesses have to borrow.
That whole issue of our debt slavery, and just first of all discovering how the mechanics of debt slavery work and how the system works to keep us in it, is a very freeing sort of a, if not a frightening and disturbing, a realization. And when we think about creating a world with a sustainable economy in which people are actually supported to be well and to thrive and prosper, this notion of scarcity has got to give way to the sufficiency that's around us for in our money.
Yeah, scarcity is a ploy to make the rich richer and to force us to pay on debts. Or austerity. Sorry, I guess austerity would be the word. The idea that government has to balance its budget as if it were a household, but of course it doesn't, because it's not a household. It has the power to issue the money it needs, which it does. That's how the government works. That when they want to buy something or pay for something, they just write checks on their Fed account. They don't look to see what's in it. There's nothing in it. The money is created by the Fed. And then at the end of the year, when the taxes come in, they feel compelled to try to balance it up. And that's when they say, oh, we don't have enough taxes. We're going to have to borrow some more. And therefore, we're going to have to slash our budget and privatize everything. But if all money comes from loans, which is how it is right now, pretty much all money comes from loans, and it all has to be paid back with interest, in order to pay all the money back that you spent into the economy, all those people have to spend their money on something. You know, the money has to come back. And a lot of people don't spend their money. They save it. So supposedly, the thought is that savings go first, and then you've got the money to lend. But it's the other way around. The savers are making it difficult because they're not putting their money out there. They're not spending their money. They're saving it. They're hoarding it, and therefore the money's not available.
So the cycling of currency needs to keep rolling as opposed to getting stuck in pockets of quote-unquote savers.
Yeah, or big investors that are not putting it in the consumer economy at all. They're putting it in all these speculative investments. So a lot of money is going into these investments where what do you have for it? The money's gone out of the system in a sense. You know, it's no longer there in the consumer economy buying goods and services, and therefore there's not enough demand, and therefore businesses close their doors. And
well, Ellen, it's been an interesting year, and next year it's going to be very exciting. I think we're going to have some new public banking realities to check out. Things are coming together around that, so we'll see what happens next. Wishing Happy New Year to you and to all of us.
And to all our listeners, and may we have some public banks blossoming soon.
The year 2017 has been one of shock and dismay for some folks who were working on public interest issues, who are seeing that the systems we operate for our common benefit and needs, such as health, education, environment and energy, infrastructure, and many more, all seem to be staying put in a deteriorating economic environment. In other words, not much progress is being made. And as new generations display increasing disinterest in the tenets of capitalist objectives and turn toward new ideas of how to reclaim some prospect of personal and societal improvement and prospect, civic activism has awakened and seems ready to create a new world with different priorities and fewer sacred cows. How do we get to this new place and these new paradigms? First of all, of course, by educating ourselves about the issues, which is what today's guests have excelled at for several years. Kevin Zeese and Dr. Margaret Flowers are the two lead protagonists of popularresistance.org, a newly revised site where key issues for action come together. Ellen and I spoke with Kevin and Margaret, two long-term supporters of public banking, in a sort of year-end assessment of where citizen efforts stand now on these civic challenges and what they foresee as matters continue to come to a head. One topic that illustrates the changes afoot is healthcare and the growing majority of people who are pushing for a single-payer Medicare for All system. Dr. Flowers, Margaret, offered these thoughts about that issue.
So it's been a really interesting time because, you know, many of us have been involved in fighting for national and for Medicare for All for a while, and we just haven't seen this level of energy for it that we see right now from all different sectors, businesses, all kinds of people that are coming out and saying, you know, we don't want to save the ACA. We actually want to go on farther than that and create access to healthcare as a public good in the United States. And so we've had legislation in the House since 2003. John Conyers was the champion for that. It's called H.R. 676, and it was really legislation that came out of the demands of the movement to create a healthcare system that's truly universal, that's paid for through progressive taxes, that has no financial barriers to care in the forms of deductibles or co-pays, and that is comprehensive in what it covers. And we've been pushing Senator Sanders to introduce companion legislation in the fall of 2016 after the election. He said he would not be introducing any Medicare for All legislation, even though he campaigned on it in the presidential run. He said because he needed to maintain Democratic Party unity and they're, you know, didn't want to divide the Democrats. They don't actually support Medicare for All in their platform nationally. And so the movement pushed back on him, and he did finally agree to introduce legislation, which he introduced in mid-September, S-1804, and it's called the Medicare for All Act. But he made some compromises at the end in order to bring more senators on as co-sponsors from the beginning. And then we had, you know, we asked him not to do that. We'd asked him to introduce something that was a very strong piece of legislation. And so some of the major flaws in Senator Sanders' legislation are that it's not comprehensive. It excludes long-term care and keeps that in Medicaid. And, of course, that's a very, you know, that's a poverty system of long-term care. It requires people to spend down their assets to go into poverty to be able to access that. And so it really creates a bad situation for a lot of people. People who have, you know, needs for long-term care at young ages have to hold their income down in order to continue to qualify. Then other things are that he actually allows investor-owned health facilities to continue to operate. So think about the for-profit kidney dialysis centers or surgical centers or laboratories or things or for-profit hospitals. But there are no budgetary constraints on them. So there's no way to really control and rein them in. He also keeps the MACRA payment mechanisms that were included in the Affordable Care Act, and these are things that require, like, pay for performance, where physicians have to do a lot of extra documentation and prove that the care they're giving is improving the quality of care for their patients, and that has all sorts of perverse mechanisms in addition to driving physicians out of practice because the paperwork is so onerous. It also you know, puts them in a position of not wanting to care for patients that aren't improving fast enough. And then if they don't do that, they need to be involved in these accountable care organizations, which is just another iteration of the health maintenance organization or managed care organization that we've seen in the past and hasn't been proven to control costs. So those are a few of the major ones. I guess one other really major one we should mention is that he has a very delayed transition period over 4 years. And during that phase-in period, it's so complex and keeps so much of the for-profit in healthcare in terms of the health insurance that it just looks like a road to ruin, that by the end of that 4 years, nobody's going to want that system because I think it's going to hit so many snags along the way, as opposed to just doing what every other country has done and what HR 676 does, which it says on a particular day, everybody is in and the system is up and running.
So HR 676, the House bill, has 120 co-sponsors. That's the most ever.
Wow.
And that's a really positive thing. But that bill takes the profit out. It doesn't allow these for-profit hospitals and dialysis centers and such. And our campaign is called Health Over Profit for Everyone, healthoverprofit.org. People can get involved there. The Sanders bill doesn't do that, and that's really the crux of the difference. Sanders did that in order to get some corporate Democrats to sign on as co-sponsors. The real issue with that long delay is Medicare Advantage. Medicare Advantage is basically code word for private insurance. It's their way to get into the Medicare system, get lots of tax dollars, but still remain a private insurance system. And we're worried that this four-year delay is going to be a chance for Medicare Advantage to continue. So we'll keep a private insurance system, but call it Medicare Advantage, and not get rid of these insurers who are really ripping off Medicare now and are ripping off the public under the ACA.
So you think the one with 120 sponsors has a better chance of passing? Actually looks very promising.
Well, I wouldn't say that it has a better chance of passing. It's been around for a longer time, and it has more support out from the movement for National Improved Medicare for All. We know that we need to continue to build this movement, and that's why we started the Health Over Profit for Everyone campaign. It brought together people from across the country that are really solid advocates for this at the national level, because that's where we see it happening. We don't see this happening at the state level. States cannot actually implement a pure type of single-payer system or a pure Medicare-for-all system. There are too many federal barriers, and so this group is focused on building, you know, strategically building the power to win National Improved Medicare for All.
Health is just one of those things that really shouldn't be for-profit. I mean, it just works.
Exactly.
If it's for-profit, you want people on drugs for a long time. I mean, your market,
yep,
is to keep them alive but not very healthy so that you have to,
yep,
keep treating them. You don't want to get them well because there goes your market. And then
go ahead. Sorry, I thought you were done.
Well, so your other big thing up till net neutrality has been the TPP. I was just reading something about how we were, like, cutting ourselves off at the knees because now we couldn't stop China from favoring their state-owned enterprises, which is what they do. But I think we should have state-owned enterprises ourselves.
Exactly.
It's such a great model. Why block them from doing something that really works? We should do it too.
That's exactly right. You know, in the TPP, as far as the United States goes, we're not involved any longer in the TPP. The Asian countries were always negotiating their own trade agreement, and they took the TPP and ran with it without the United States. They changed it a bit, and so now there is a new version of the TPP for Asian countries that does not include the United States. Now, one of the goals of the TPP for Obama was part of this Asian pivot. The United States wanted to dominate Asia, and this was the economic domination. There's also an Asian pivot of military troops, again, negotiating agreements with lots of countries in Asia for military bases and joint defense agreements. And so this was really a part of an empire strategy of dominating Asia. Now the United States can no longer do that. But the United States can negotiate trade agreements with individual countries as is appropriate, but the TPP for us is no longer alive. And now it could come back to life. Asia may have their own version, and the United States could join that down the road. So we'll have to keep aware of that and be ready to fight that. But we're seeing a lot of the same issues coming up in NAFTA. Trump comes out and says he's against NAFTA and wants to do something to improve it. Well, the things he's talking about improving really are not the kinds of things we talk about. He's not doing anything about worker protections and environmental protections. He's doing protections for corporations, more, corporate courts to decide disputes. He's not really doing anything that's for the people. He's doing some actions for the corporations, but it may all fall apart. We'll see. He's threatening to leave, and that would probably be the best choice.
NAFTA.
Yeah, NAFTA.
Interesting. It would seem to me that corporations would be very much promoting and wanting to have that. I don't see why, if he comes out smelling like he was on the people's side, but his corporate interests are would be better served by sticking with these things, don't you think?
In these NAFTA renegotiations, they are trying to insert some of the language that we saw in the Trans-Pacific Partnership about the corporate courts that Kevin mentioned, about protections for patent protections that give corporations much longer times to control the market and things like pharmaceuticals and other things. But the U.S. is being, just as we were in the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, very aggressive. And Mexico and Canada are pushing back against the United States on that. And so President Trump doesn't feel like he's getting his way, and that's why he's blustering about, threatening to leave it, hoping that that will cause Canada and Mexico to come around more and accept more of the demands of the United States.
I would say, Walt, you're exactly right about this benefiting corporations. They sell this as free trade agreements, but these are really corporate trade agreements. The negotiators all come from big business interests. Always the U.S. trade representative comes from Wall Street or some other mega corporate interest. And the negotiators, the advisors to the U.S. trade rep are all these large corporations. These are negotiations of, by, and for the corporations, on behalf of the corporations. And you're right, they would want to stay in, but Trump is trying to get what he considers a better deal for U.S. corporations.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't make a bad segue into the discussion about the Internet, the repositioning of the Internet as a new, more profitable corporate tool. And you guys are taking a frontline stand against that. Of course, the FCC net neutrality thing has just been decided, and now you're pushing back in a big way. Tell us about the campaign that you've got underway with that now.
Sure. The campaign is called Protect Our Internet, and people can check it out at protectourinternet.org. And as you remember, back in 2014 and 2015, we were involved in the coalition that really fought to win reclassification of the Internet as a common carrier so that the FTC had the legal authority and legal power to really protect people from these large telecom corporations like Verizon and AT&T and Comcast, and make sure that everybody had equal access to content on the Internet. And Chairman Pai, the current chair of the FCC, who was there under Obama, was appointed by Obama, was opposed to the net neutrality rules then, and he came in as chair this year with a preset agenda to dismantle those rules. So that was really interesting that the chair actually came in with an agenda to dismantle rules that were working very well and that the telecommunications companies were actually doing fine with. So there was a lot of pushback through the year, tremendous organizing by the coalition of organizations involved, a tremendous number of comments into the FCC rallying, to protect net neutrality. And of course, the Chairman Pai has two other commissioners on his side, and so they voted to dismantle those rules. But that's not the end of this. There are immediate actions that groups are taking, organizations are taking. One is to bring, sue the FCC over that decision, and Kevin can probably talk about that a little bit more. Another is to use something called the Congressional Review Act, which allows Congress to revoke a decision made by a federal agency. We support those moves, and we'll be mobilizing people to push for the revocation of that decision through the Congressional Review Act. But we're also pushing people to think more broadly. Let's go beyond net neutrality. There are a lot of things that need to be changed about current internet or telecommunications law, because it really was written before we were in the situation that we are today, where people need access to the internet in their daily lives for their regular activities of daily living, for education, and for their businesses. And so how do we actually protect the right to access to the internet, high speed, free or affordable access to the internet and really push for a broader vision of what we want to see going forward.
So I noticed that in New Jersey there is a bill that's being presented to do just that, to counteract the Net Neutrality Act. To require that ISPs, the internet service providers, are fairly distributing content at speeds that are demonstrable, and that they will make notice an official declaration how much they're charging by itemizing the charges that they might be. So there's pushback at the state level. That's yet another exciting development of how the people are starting to take new positions on these issues.
Well, that's true. In Washington State, the governor has said we're going to put in place net neutrality in the state, no matter what the federal government does. One of the things, though, that the FCC did under Chairman Pai's rule is to not allow state to protect net neutrality under state law. So that's an interesting conflict. Whether that will hold up in court or not is a question. And about a little less than 20 attorneys generals have joined a lawsuit against the FCC decision. So they're suing, nonprofits are suing. There's a lot going on that front. And Margaret mentioned the action in Congress. And so there's lots of ways to get involved. Now, the thing about all three of the issues we talked about, the trade issue, the net neutrality issue, and the health issue, these are all areas we have campaigns which people can get involved with on our main website, which is popularresistance.org. We just redid that website, by the way. All the campaigns are there, and you can sign up for each campaign to get mailings on each. The thing that's common about all three is it's the classic overall fight of our times. It's people and people organizing power to challenge corporate power and challenge the power of the wealthy. It's people versus corporations, each one of these conflicts. If we solve the healthcare crisis, Ellen, you mentioned China, state-owned enterprises, because we put in place Medicare for everybody. Medicare is a government program. One of the arguments for net neutrality is now we should look at internet access as a human right. It's essential for functioning. And that means that this should be under democratic control. It shouldn't be something that a handful of corporations control. When we talk about trade, we talk about trade for people and planet. It's people and environment-based trade versus corporate-dominated trade. So it's all these issues. And it's the same with the issue of public banking that you all work for, Ellen. Again, who controls finance? Is it going to be a handful of big banks on Wall Street, or is it going to be democratically controlled banks like public banks? And beyond that could be credit unions, which are worker-owned banking systems. And so this is the overall challenge that we're facing, and the issues we're talking about today really show this is the issue that unites the movement into a movement of movements on a whole number of fronts.
So I want to remind the listeners that the Internet was actually created through our taxpayer dollars through the Department of Defense, and then that got turned over to those telecom communications who are not only controlling our access to it in terms of speed and things, but they also are buying up content. And so they can start prioritizing their content over other content because they want to make more money off of their content. And so an exciting movement in this realm is cities creating their own municipally owned internet, and they are able to provide higher quality, faster speed, and universal access to the internet, because these telecoms come into cities and they don't provide access to the entire city. They don't go into the neighborhoods where they don't think they're going to make a profit. And so we actually can serve people better if we bring the internet back in under public control, just like water or a public utility.
I totally agree. More it's banks. One of those things that flows between people like money. I mean, it's one of those things that should be in the public sector. I read somewhere, I think James Galbraith said that half of every economy is public and half is private, roughly. But in our case, the half that's public is the military. Now, if we could, put some of those enlisted men on local projects or, rebuild like infrastructure or something, local infrastructure, instead of sending them off abroad, that would be much more.
Well, if you look at foreign policy, then you get to really interesting issues about our economy, because we really have what I would call an empire economy. And while that served people in the United States for a while with less expensive goods and didn't undermine our job situation, now it's no longer serving people in the United States. And the U.S. empire is under great stress. The U.S. hasn't won a war really since World War II. and at least not any significant war. The expense is massive as far as the expense to our discretionary federal spending goes. We have bases from all over the world. Trump just broke the record for a number of countries where we have special operations. 149 countries now, the United States has military special ops, working. And so the question is, how do you end empire? Because empire is no longer serving us and is fading. And it's not producing the kind of economic benefits. It's an economic drain. And so how do we end empire? And I think your comment about those people who are enlisted now or in the military leaving the military, becoming civilians, and beginning to work on the needs at home. You know, when Trump ran on America First, traditionally America First was an anti-war group, you know, back in the pre-World War II era. But when he runs, now he has generals put in even his chief of staff is a former general. So he's put generals in lots of different parts of the government. He's increased the military spending. He's increased spending on improving nuclear weapons, and he's now put us in more countries than any president before him. So he's been the opposite of America First. He's been America abroad first, and domestically, he's doing is helping the wealthy. You can see in the current tax bill. It's not a bill for the people. It's a bill for the ultra rich, and so this is a real a scam that needs to be exposed, and because we expect to see a boomerang to these years. And our position now on all these issues we've talked about is to define what we want. What do we want from healthcare? What do we want from trade? What do we want from the internet? How do we serve ourselves and the future generations? And I think that all comes down to that fight about public versus corporate, and that's the fight.
Mm-hmm. One reason the military it maintains its popularity is that many people, that's their job. But
yep.
You wouldn't necessarily have to unenlist them. You could switch them over to civil programs, it seems to me,
right.
That were still paid by the government. But infrastructure, the trillion-dollar infrastructure project, they could work on that, perhaps. So, anyway.
Well, I was going to say that the physician in me also believes that transitioning our military, you know, people away from going into other countries and, you know, doing the destructive work that they do there, transitioning them into more constructive work here at home would also just be so much healthier for them. I was talking to a young vet recently, and when I asked him about, you know, what he liked about the military, he liked it when they were going into after, you know, hurricanes and helping people out, or after blizzards and helping people out. And I just think it would be a whole switch away from being a destructive killing force to being an actually constructive helping force.
Right. Or even they could help people abroad, which, I mean,
right.
I've heard that too. People that's the satisfying part of it.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm a little more radical. I don't think she's done through the military. I think we have to recognize the military is designed for a certain purpose. That's war and destruction. It's not designed to build bridges. We need to move people out of the military, shrink the military part of our budget, and put it into real civilian programs. That's my perspective. I don't see why we want to keep the military going, doing civilian jobs. We need social workers. We don't need soldiers. We need bridge builders. We need road fixers. We don't, you know. So I say let's face the reality. We've overbuilt our military. Let's start underfunding it and shift to the civilian economy we need. So people will get jobs, but they're just not going to be military jobs. They'll get jobs to build infrastructure. They'll get jobs to do health care. They'll get jobs to do social work. There's lots of teaching jobs. We are underfunding all those areas. And so I'm just saying, let's stop the military expansion. Let's shrink the military, and people will get jobs in these other areas. But why under the military? We don't need the Department of Defense with the boondoggle of corruption that it is to be leading these efforts on these areas where we need services.
Okay, agreed.
Net
neutrality, I did have one question. You know, you see these horrible towers that are giving off all this, I mean, I don't know what you call those poles that they're trying to conceal, like they look like trees, but they're really these very intense radiation coming out of these things. Now, if you have different providers, do they all have different systems? Or it seems to me they should be sharing the same system so we're not getting radiated to death by a bunch of different ISPs, but maybe we're not. I don't really know how that works.
No question, the infrastructure should be shared, and there is research on the radiation from these towers, and I think we need to really not be shy about emphasizing that, really studying the impact and taking action. These systems, you know, they need to be regulated. We just can't let these be for-profit enterprises without regulation, especially the way it's currently where we have regional monopolies, you know, where people have no choice but are stuck with a monopoly internet service provider. And so regulation, if you're not going to break these down into multiple different internet service providers, of course, I agree, using the same infrastructure, they need to be heavily regulated to serve the people's needs.
The private internet systems are in so many instances so much better. I know the city of Chattanooga is I think the first gigabit city in the country, which is not unusual in Europe, but here in the U.S., Chattanooga was on the ropes financially. But a number of years ago, started public utility programs, including the internet, which have been enormously successful, and they're cranking and they're bringing in a lot of revenue. So the tussle between public interest and private corporate agendas brings all of this to the fore. What we've been talking about is the people against corporations. And Kevin, I'm aware of your history with Ralph Nader, who brought this to our attention back in the 70s, I guess, that there was that the corporate America was taking over our democracy and our interests. So it's perfect that you're still talking about the same thing. And congratulations to you both for popularresistance.org and all of the work that you're doing in this. I want to go back to the health thing for just a second about costs. One of the things that I'm seeing on your screen over the healthoverprofit.org page is that the cost for medical expenses is enormous here compared to others.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the United States is exceptional in a number of ways, and one of them is that we have such a market-based healthcare system, and so that makes it the most expensive system in the world. We spend the most per person per year on healthcare, even though we leave out a large segment of the population that doesn't have access to insurance, and we don't have a system that actually controls the cost of goods or services. You know, people see it quite openly with pharmaceutical prices and how pharmaceutical companies are raising the prices of medications, you know, hundreds, thousands of times over what they should be and way over what it costs to actually produce them. And that's because we don't have a system that actually organizes those. So if we cut out the administrative waste that we have in the United States with all the different private insurances, we spend about a third of our healthcare dollar just on that paperwork dealing with all those insurance companies. So coming down to a universal system that's one system, Medicare for all, that would save us, it's estimated, around $500 billion a year on paperwork. And not just money saving, but also time saving. Physicians are now spending about twice as much time on paperwork as they spend with their actual patients. And so that's hurting, you know, the quality of care that's given in this country. But then other parts of the system would be negotiating fair prices for services, negotiating fair prices for pharmaceuticals. The pharmaceutical negotiations are estimated to save us about $100 billion a year. And so there have been a number of studies done at the national level, dating back into the 1990s, done by the General Accounting Office, done by the Congressional Budget Office, and they show that if we simplified our system, simplified the administration, negotiated for prices, the amount of savings that we would get from that would allow us to cover everyone with comprehensive coverage and no upfront out-of-pocket costs like copays or deductibles. In fact, they found that the way that co-pays and deductibles save money is that they deter people from getting care, so they use less services. And there's actually more administrative costs when you have co-pays and deductibles because you have to do the paperwork of collecting them. So we're actually already paying for a universal healthcare system. We're just not getting it.
When people don't get the healthcare they need, it leads to greater costs later. Rather than solving a health problem early, it ends up being some kind of major operation down the road that's more expensive. But what Margaret's talking about is that how when you have a one payer, It simplifies things, how you can control budgets of hospitals, how you can control planning for areas to make sure you don't duplicate expensive equipment. You can do a lot with one payer to negotiate drug prices. And so one payer is what makes it so efficient and reduces the burden on doctors on paperwork, hospitals on paperwork. Everyone's overhead is reduced significantly. And this is why states are unable to put in place a state-based single payer. This is really a critical issue that people need to understand. So many states are trying to pursue single payer. None have been successful. Usually when they call it single payer, it's not really single payer. It really is a multi-payer system with trying to achieve universal coverage. That's honest. That's what they're trying to do. But that's not going to be as efficient or as inexpensive as a one-payer or single-payer system. And you can't do it on a state level because there are about 5 federal laws that a state law would conflict with. And you need to have either waivers from HHS or laws passed in Congress to allow a state to incorporate that into a single-payer system. And so there are laws that you have to go through Congress in order to get a real single-payer at the state level. If you can't get a real single-payer, it's not going to be efficient. Vermont never tried single-payer. California never tried single-payer. Colorado never tried it. New York, they called it single-payer, but none of those proposals were actually single-payer, and that's why they all became too expensive to afford.
Wow, that's very interesting. I had one more comment about the Internet. I heard Catherine Austin Fitz interviewed someone in Australia who was an expert on it was an interview on 5G and how horribly toxic mm-hmm. this is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, 5G is necessary for all the expansion of all these things that we actually like. You know, it's very handy to have your cell phone, et cetera. And so this man said that it actually could be fixed. The toxicity part could be fixed. You just have to overlay it with the resonance of the Earth, which is 7.83 hertz, I guess. So I just thought that was, you know, while you're out there campaigning, if that issue ever comes up, just point out there is a fix. It just will cost a little money, and, of course, they're going to be opposed to it. But if it's the people worried about their own health, they would incorporate that in there.
It's a very interesting point because when countries have health systems where the bottom line is health, they're universal
right.
systems, publicly financed, it actually has a wider impact on public policy because now these countries are responsible for paying for the, you know, health care for everyone. So they don't want to actually create increased costs for themselves, healthcare costs. So it impacts public policy, things like public transportation, having clean, you know, reliable public transportation so fewer people drive, or making sure that the foods that people eat are, you know, are safe, they don't contain pesticides, making sure that the products that people buy don't contain hazardous chemicals. It really has this broader health impact.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
You know, we keep seeing this contrast between what is in the interest of the public and logical, commonsensical sort of steps and policies that are in the public, and how they are always confronted with the corporate interests, which are perpetuating programs and technologies that we don't necessarily need, but that are frequently harmful to us. How are we going to get past that? How do you guys see the phasing into some different world? Where we're not all the serfs and the renters in a society that's owned by others and run by corporate interests?
That's a great question. And that's why the issues we're talking about today are also important, because they all crystallize that conflict. The position Ellen talked about with the 5Gs and the health risks, that's another example of profit coming before people, profit coming before health. And all these issues have that same nut that really surrounds it. Which is coming first, the corporate interest or the interest of the people and the planet? And that is the fight. And so when we win any one of these issues, you know, let me just take a little different attack at it. I'm really seeing in the future, with the extremism of Trump, and the long-term corporate reality of the Democratic and Republican parties, the duopoly. You know, we have been fed in the United States this dangerous corporate food, this corporate ideology that profits of corporations come before people and planet. And there's going to be Trump is so extreme on this that there's going to be a boomerang in the future. and not too distant future. And the reaction to that, Trumpism and corporatism of the duopoly, is ours to manage, push, and dominate. This is the chance coming up for people power to really push for the world we want to see, which is a world in which people and people's necessities, where the planet and protecting the planet, dealing with climate change, all these issues will come to the front if we are smart now and define what we want on all these health issues we're talking about, from healthcare to trade to militarism to the internet. We need to define what we want. And when we really get serious about defining that, it does come down to what do human beings need? What is the necessity of the people? And that comes down to the fight between corporate power and people power. And I think that's going to be resolved in the 2020s. I think we're going to see an amazing, just like during Obama, we saw a reaction with the Occupy movement calling on the wealth divide, the Black Lives Matter, on black violence and racism against African-American communities, on immigration movements, on Fight for 15. These all happened during the Obama years, the Democrat years. They were a reaction, though, to Bush. Bush's right-wing extremism pushed in Obama. Obama raised the rhetoric up of hope and change. It didn't happen, so people formed movements to try to force it to happen. This is not going to be an unusual reality. This is going to happen in the future, too. The Democratic Party will still nominate a corporate Democrat. The progressives in the Democratic Party will try to push it toward more of a progressive corporate Democrat. It will still be a corporate Democrat. It's up to the movements, for the people, to define what we want on all these issues that are necessities, and force that through and push this boomerang further than either duopoly party wants it to go. That's how I see it happening. But we have to do our job now of setting the framework, laying the groundwork, and organizing the people.
Just to say popular resistance, we do write about this frequently and, provide articles on strategy. But there's a lot of research now on social movements and what movements are successful and the stages of successful social movements. And it really boils down to having a national consensus on issues and then having at least 3.5% of the population mobilized and active on pushing for those issues. So we don't need to have 80% of the country out there in the streets if we had 3 to 5% of the country out there in the streets, calling for these things, and we have a consensus on what we want to see, we'll win. We also really promote a two-track approach, and this is not new. This has been done throughout time, and it's both resisting the harmful policies that we see, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but also building alternative systems to replace the current dysfunctional systems that we have. All of these actions, both the resistance and the constructive actions, are part of this movement, this transformational movement. And so when people are working to create public banks in their city or their state, or they're stopping fossil fuel projects and pushing for clean energy projects, this is all moving us in the direction towards the social transformation that we're seeking.
And that we're seeing around
exactly.
The country.
I actually think it's exciting times. I mean, the fact that, as Kevin says, things are so outrageous that it's getting people out in the streets. And Trump has been described as a great wrecking ball, taking down old structures. For example, in public banking, like, we know what we're trying to achieve, but there's a rule against it, and there's this rule against it, and that rule against it. First, you've got to get people disillusioned with what you've got right now. Otherwise, they're going to say, oh, the system's fine, we don't need to fix it. So I think it's great what you're doing, that you're leading the charge in all these transformative things, areas.
Well, we're actually more riding the wave, because on all these issues we talk about, we already have mass support. And I'm talking about 65% in some of these areas, but on net neutrality, for example, 83% of the public is with us. 3 out of 4 Republicans are with us, according to the University of Maryland study just a week ago. On healthcare, 80% of Democrats are with us. I mean, so we're already achieving, we already have 65% support. Now we want to get the supermajority. That's how, when Margaret talked about national consensus, that's what we're talking about. We're going to be doing, by the way, one thing we're doing in the next couple months, our movement, our schools, on popular resistance, and these will be web-based schools. The first schools we're going to do are on movements. How do movements grow? How do movements win? And we're going to go through the history of movements. We're going to go through strategies and tactics. and we're going to explain to people how you build a movement that can actually win. And it's not something it's going to be based on not on just our experience, but on experience of the last 100 years and beyond of social movements that have won and ones that have lost. So you can see what works and what doesn't. And I think we are really, since the Occupy movement, that was kind of an awakening moment for the country, and it's been building since then in a more quiet way, but it's been building. It's very widespread. Now we have to find the opportunity. I think it's going to be in the early 1920s, when we see this opportunity to push the movements forward in ways that we can't imagine right now.
Yeah. It's, as Dylan said, the times, they are changing.
Right.
And as Gandhi said, when the people will lead, the leaders will follow.
That's
and,
right.
And now is a great time. This is a lovely conversation to wrap up 2017. It's been a challenging year, a breakthrough year in so many ways. A lot of things have been broken, but there is no more time to waste for the people to begin to take up their responsibility as citizens to get on with what our real values demand, and that is to prioritize people and life and the planet over greed and acquisition and accumulation, etc. It's a transformative time, and we want to thank you, Dr. Flowers, you know, Margaret and Kevin, thank you so much for your leadership, for the hard work you put in. We want to tell our listeners to go to popularresistance.org. There you'll get the whole menu of things that Margaret and Kevin are working on, which is a really, as they say, a really wonderful compendium of focused on issues with the data behind it. Thank you so much, both of you.
Thanks,
thank
Charlie.
You. Thank you
Thanks
for
your
work.
Thank
you. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.